Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for February 29th, 2024, and quite a few topics to cover tonight, talking about, a little bit about the Odysseus, old Greek name, Odysseus lander that landed on the moon, and excuse me, but talk about baloney, you know, to the 10th power. Anyway. I'll be talking a little bit about that, a little bit about SpaceX, but what I want to talk about tonight is that the fact that we have to put science somewhat into perspective. And so I'll be doing that in terms of, let's say, look at space science, astronomy, astrophysics, and our role in this universe. And you could take the attitude that, you know, the old adage of a flea on the back of a flea on the back of a flea on the back of a flea. And we're kind of like that on this planet Earth, which is a speck of dust, literally, in a solar system that is so vast, very few people have any clue how small Earth is relative to the solar system we live in, and how little amount of this space in the solar system is occupied by matter, like Jupiter, the biggest planet. It's not a planet, it's a small unlit star. It's actually lit a little bit, only visible in the infrared, so it's not glowing like a bright star, but it is a star. But even Jupiter is kind of a speck of dust, and we're, you know, 100,000 times smaller than that. 10 times the diameter smaller, let's just put it that way. And Jupiter is 1/10 the diameter of the Sun. And, you know, the distance to the next star is an astronomical distance. Most people cannot comprehend that. And that is just a small piece of this galaxy we live in. But then, again, you look at the importance I don't like to use this word intelligent life, because that's questionable. In today's world, it's very hard to find real intelligent life. It's the old joke from the Star Trek movie, where, you know, they're down on the planet Earth, and Captain Kirk says, "Beam me up, Scotty, there's no intelligent life down here." Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about putting science into perspective as we move into a chaotic world, absolutely chaos coming. One thing I should mention right away before I forget is that the frequency that this show airs on is going to change. The March 7th show, which will be next week, will be the last show on the 5.935 megahertz frequency from WWCR Tower Number 2. And on the March 14th show will be the first time for the summertime frequency, 9.350. So once again, next week we'll still be on, if you're listening on shortwave, and you should be, by the way, I insist that you get a shortwave radio and listen to this show, 6 p.m. Central Time, WWCR Nashville, Tennessee, the frequency 5.935, and if you don't have a shortwave radio and you go out and buy one, make sure you get a shortwave radio that goes down into the 3 megahertz range. That's a lot of the cheapy radios out there don't go down very far. There's a lot of good content down in those lower megahertz frequency ranges. Okay, and so anyway, next week, March 7th, 5.935 megahertz, the last week, March 14th will be the first time we start the summertime frequency, 9.350. And I do this change every week because, or every week, sorry, every year, spring and fall, once in the fall, once in the spring, because my show sits at 6 o'clock p.m., right where on those dates in March we're transitioning into longer days, which means my show is in daylight when it's airing, as opposed to winter time when it's dark when my show is airing. And so that has something to do with the best frequency to transmit shortwave. Okay, so enough of that in terms of what's going on electrically with this electric radio show, in its 24th commercial free year, by the way. Okay, so SpaceX doing some amazing work. They're launching like every day now. They just have business coming out their ears. They just launched, had a successful launch of the biggest rocket ever made. I mean, these are fantastic rockets. And, you know, just follow it. I'm not going to go through everything that they're doing. But they are doing what NASA was supposed to do, what NASA never did. If you look at agencies, whether it's the EPA, whether it's HUD, housing industry, you know, government agencies relative to, say, National Science Foundation, all of the government agencies are designed to do something, that, say, the Transportation Department. What's their job? Is to make sure all the roads are good. How about the federal, Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. Their job is to make sure that the facilities that are rolled out, some of them privately owned, some of them owned by the government, some of them funded by the government with private enterprise involved. Like, take our road system, for example. A good example of what a federal agency should be doing is making sure we have good highways. And what is a highway used for? Well, you want to go visit grandma. You get out in your car, you get on the highway, you go visit grandma. You know, the exit where you get off at grandma's street should be in good condition. You know, the road where you, local road, then that goes into the local municipality. And all of this should be managed by a government agency. That's what they're supposed to do. Okay, how about the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission? You know, they're supposed to make sure that when you listen to my radio show, it's not being interfered with by some other station, that, you know, that the there's coordination so that people aren't running over each other, like in the radio industry or the television, whatever. If there's a cable company that comes into town, that they're giving putting in a product that is, first of all, it's going to work, that it's not dangerous, that it's not going to have after effects for the health and safety of the public. All of these things government agencies are supposed to do. But what has NASA done in terms of a federal agency, in terms of you out there? Nothing. Their job is to create a highway to the heavens, so that you can get in your space vehicle and go up there and do stuff in orbit as a business. You know, and like my example, when you're driving over to grandma's house, alongside you on the highway is a big truck full of stuff, and he's got to go to the city, he's got to go out to the country, pick up products, take products out to the country where the farmers need them. And all of this is happening on a publicly defined utility, the highway system. Okay, so the whole issue here is that the NASA has not done what it's supposed to do, what it should have done 50 years ago, instead of defining a plan to send three guys to the moon so they could walk around and everybody could have a ticker tape parade in New York. Instead of doing that, what they were supposed to do was provide a mechanism for average people, companies, etc., to get into space. Just like driving on the highway, just picking up your phone and talking to your grandma. Just like, you know, all of the other, just like when you take a drink of water, it's supposed to be clean. The Environmental Protection Agency, I call it the Environmental Pollution Agency, because it's legalized pollution. So, oh, you can, you're a company over here, you can pollute this month much. You get a license to pollute. You can pollute a little bit, but that little bit with tens of thousands of companies adds up to major pollution. So I call them the Environmental Pollution Agency, because that's what they've done. You know, not all of these government agencies do a good job. A lot of them really don't have authorization under the Constitution to do what they're doing. But anyway, we do need coordination, otherwise you have chaos. organized, unorganized chaos. Anyway, NASA, their edict, their goal, their proposition in being a government agency should have been to provide a highway, a pathway up to the orbit or whatever, for and that would allow companies, say, that had a product to build their own spacecraft, use the government facilities, etc. Well, SpaceX is doing what NASA was supposed to do, building a highway up to the orbit, for companies to, and so that's going on right now. So, very interesting. And when you see what Musk is doing, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, they're doing what the government agency, which had billions and billions of federal funding every year, what they didn't do, Musk is doing on his own, and making a business out of it, a profitable business. Okay, and not the least of which, right now they're getting ready to send eight astronauts up to the International Space Station. And so they're starting to have human traffic in their payloads. Okay, so anyway, this is let me just change gears a little bit. Now what NASA is doing is they're coordinating private companies. Okay, and that's the case with the Odysseus lander, which recently, just a couple days ago, landed on the moon, toppled over, according to the official story, which I don't believe. I believe that it's doing just fine, but they don't want pictures of the surface of the moon. And so this thing landed near the South Pole of the moon, and they're talking about looking for water, because they think they can use that to create fuel for future lunar landing missions. And of course, water is a very heavy thing to carry around. And if you can find it in outer space, it would be advantageous. But are you going to find water that's like water on Earth? Probably not. You're going to find water that's mixed with other stuff, or the concentrations are different, or the water that you see in outer space is very different than the water that you find here on planet Earth. I don't know if anybody ever told NASA that, but at any rate, I think that the quest to find water on the South Pole of both the Moon and Mars are bogus ideas. Like I say, first of all, the water is not going to be pure water like you find on Earth. If you want to use it for fuel, that's probably not too important. It's hard to say, but the hydrogen that you separate out, that's the fuel, and then you have to have oxygen. You have to save those because you don't have oxygen like you have in the atmosphere of Earth. The quantity of oxygen in the atmosphere, latent in the atmosphere, native in the atmosphere. So you would have to save that, and then you would have to produce that and store it on, in outer space, basically, or on the surface of these planets, because the lunar surface, there's no atmosphere. Mars has very little atmosphere. And so it's a big order to try and find water. Let's imagine that NASA found a big lake of water at the South Pole of Mars, or on the moon, in some behind some of these craters, a big frozen chunk of ice. First of all, it's going to be very limited, and in the quantities they would be using would be used up very quickly. It's probably out there in large quantities. And then the second issue would be, how do you go out and get it? Like, this would be some kind of a mining operation, where you'd be digging up dirt and the water would be mixed in with the dirt, if it's there. Because you have to remember that these are very low pressure, and ice under very low pressure is going to melt, or is going to vaporize, basically. It's going to go right from the ice stage into a gaseous state because of the low pressure. Actually, the correct term is sublimation. And so going from a solid to the vapor state, So the idea that you're somehow going to mine water or get water from the moon or from Mars or something and have it be usable is just fantasy. I'm in the water filtration business, and if you get water on planet Earth, which is real water, the kind of water we're used to having on planet Earth, it's in a lot of cases very difficult to get pure water, just regular pure water that you can drink. So how are you going to do this on Mars or on, when you have no idea what might be mixed in with this and at what levels? One thing about filtration, there's all kinds of misunderstandings about filtration of water or just in general, cleaning up water so it's usable. And some people think, distillation, you get pure water. No. You don't get pure water with distillation. What you get is water and anything with a boiling point lower than water is going to be in your mix, in the distillation soup. So, and that could include a lot of things. And it's never perfect because that vapor is going to carry things with it. So it's going to be very difficult to clean the water up and get it into a state that we think, oh, there's water there. People are thinking, oh, yeah, you're going to go up in some crater in the moon and take a chunk of it and put it out in the sunlight, melts in your glass, and you're going to drink it. No, not at all, boys and girls. So anyway, it just drives me crazy to hear these NASA pie in the sky. Oh, we're going to do this. We're going to the South Pole of the Moon because there might be water there. Anyway, just craziness, craziness, and it shows that they really haven't thought about this. But it doesn't matter because the whole purpose of NASA's space program is to burn up time and plan on things. Look, they're going to spend this whole decade. They're now saying, oh, well, we put off space exploration to the moon till 2026 with the Artemis program. I guarantee you it's going to stretch out to 2029. They're going to burn up this entire decade talking about going to the moon. And it's the hope of every engineer, administrator, scientist working on these projects at NASA that they will be able to retire before this damn thing pulls off or doesn't pull off, whatever the case. And they'll be on the course, the golf course, golfing down in Arizona, and it'll be all history. They'll be on their pension, and nobody will be any the wiser. That is the main hope of anybody in any of these programs. And there's a lot of lack of reality here, too. Even with as smart as Musk is, he seems to be totally oblivious to the concept of radiation in space, the Van Allen belts, other radiation. Earth itself has 17 local electrical batteries around it, plasma batteries that can be potentially hazardous under the right conditions or the wrong conditions, however you consider it. It's not like you just go out of the atmosphere and it's just like wake-free zone, it's like when you go out on a big lake in a big boat, the lake, the wake-free zone, you can just go wherever you want. And no, outer space is dangerous, and radiation is the number one danger guy out there. None of these people have gone beyond Earth orbit, low Earth orbit. And they're going to have some serious surprises when they do. There was the case where the space shuttle astronauts went up to typically the low Earth orbit where the International Space Station, etc., is. We're within a couple hundred miles of the Earth's surface at most. There was a point at which, in the early days of the shuttle, where they went up higher and the astronauts' eyebrows started to glow. And there was electricity coming off their eyelashes. And literally, they became like one of these high school experiments where you have a evacuated ball, and inside you have a high potential metal ball or something like that, and you have all these rays going out That's what was going on in the space shuttle with the astronauts. They were the extension of the electric field because the spacecraft was charging. And NASA doesn't understand why or what was going on, but they brought those guys back down and they've never gone there since. They've never, they're talking about going to the moon, going to the Mars, just like, well, let's just put our backpacks on, just kind of walk outside here, take a walk through the forest. No, it's not like that at all. So, low Earth orbit is a very, very, very protected area, radiation free because of the layers of magnetic field, charged particles coming in that are, say, coming in from the sun that get through our deep space magnetic field, 30,000 miles out from the planet Earth, they get trapped into the Van Allen belt. So they really don't get down close to low Earth orbit. It's like a protective shield. But you get out into the lower Van Allen belt, and those things change. It's not like you can measure where the Van Allen belt is today and tomorrow it's going to be in the same spot. No, they're changing, they're expanding. They're wobbling, they're pulsing, they're interacting with each other. And they have no studies going on about this at all. NASA had a program, it was called Living with a Star. And this was goes way back into the 90s. It might even go back into the 80s. Program was called Living with a Star. And they had every scientist and his brother on the payroll, physicists, chemists, etc., trying to understand how they would get through the Van Allen belts. I refer to this, I was just listening to one of my talks. It's on my DVD, historically important lectures that I gave. And it was one that I gave at the UFO Congress. I think it was either 2003 or 2004. I gave it 2 years in a row. I was at that the UFO Congress giving talks. And I talked about the Living with the Star program, that this was in place, and NASA, admittedly didn't know how to get through the Van Allen belts, which is strange because supposedly all these astronauts from the Apollo program went to the moon, came back, lived a long, healthy life, no problems, no medical problems. So why would NASA be so concerned about getting through the radiation belts? Doggone, it shouldn't have been any problem. Well, I can tell you there is a problem. Okay, so this brings me into the night's main science topic, which is putting science into perspective. Where are we today? Where are we going? And this is really important, this for everybody out there, because your birthright, and I've said this before, this is one of my main themes that I've carried with me throughout decades and decades of talking to you, the public. Your birthright as a human being is in the stars. One of the things, if you look around at the animals, your dog, your cat, the monkeys in the zoo, the apes, who supposedly were evolved from. The giraffes, the elephants, the snakes, the whatever, the creatures, the whales that live in the ocean. None of them, let me repeat that, none of them put their head up, look at the stars, and wonder, gee, what are those little dots up there in the sky? No, not a single one of them do that. Just people. There's something special about people. And this is not, as Carl Sagan would have you believe, because you have a little bit bigger brain than the monkeys still out there in the jungle. No. You have a spirit that is ingrained in you, and this spirit is connected to the universe. It's something very exciting, and most people don't have a clue that they have a spirit living in them that gives them their personality, that makes them. Makes you, makes me. And it's not just your physical body. There's a spirit living in there that makes musicians create music in different ways, makes people listen to that music. For example, there's music. Take a song like, say something popular, like that one from the movie Frozen, where she's leaving and the storm is raging and It's like something, it's so universal. And this is where it's really telling is with little kids. You're in a shopping mall and you hear these little boys and girls singing that song. And the parents will say, "Oh, it drives me crazy. This kid sings this song day and night." But the little kids are just fascinated. There's something about that song. Or say, for older people, like the theme from the movie Titanic, an epic movie that took 2 years in filming, and it's just, like it's you're there, you're on the Titanic. But the music, for someone, that's what's very interesting too, is that for someone to write a musical score with Irish music, all brand new, and have it be some of the best Irish music ever written, of the vast amounts of Irish music, that the theme from Titanic is just incredible, and it moves you. You listen to it, and it just like makes the hair in the back of your neck stand up, if you have hair in the back of your neck. I have a little bit, but the point is that it's the spirit in the people. It's the spirit that's moving you, that is connected to your physical body. It's not your physical body that hears it and goes in your brain and connects with neurons and synapses. No. There's a whole lot more going on here in the human body. So getting back to the stars and your birthright to the stars, the spirit is connected to your body, and it has a desire to travel, to seek new things, to have adventure. And a lot of people are squelched of this when they're little. You can't do that. You can't go into space. It's dangerous. Only NASA can go there. NASA has turned into this cloistered, only can be done it here attitude, and they keep failing and they keep putting it off. But what they're, like I say, NASA's main goal, and it's not something they're going to tell you, it's not written any place. Their main goal is to prevent you from going into space or thinking that you can go into space. Let's go back to the Middle Ages. Remember the flat Earth societies in the Middle Ages? And I'm not talking about the modern goofy stuff on the YouTube or whatever. I'm talking about the Middle Ages, where the Catholic Church, which was the main instructing body in the world, in what you might call the Western world, because the Eastern world had their own instructing bodies and bodies of knowledge, etc. But in the Western world, they taught that the earth was flat. But you got guys like Columbus, or the queens and the kings, and the certain scientists, philosophers, etc., knew that the world was round, and they could measure it. The Greeks, the ancient Greeks, measured it pretty accurately. Columbus had a relatively good measurement of the earth. But he thought that when he got to South America and hit the islands, the first islands he got to, he thought he was in India. That's why he called the India, that's why we call Indians Indians. They're not Indians. He thought he was in India. He thought the earth was smaller than what it was. He was looking, he had his Perry Reese map. He was looking for the coastline of Antarctica, which at the time he went was covered with ice, wasn't visible. But the ancient Phoenician mariners, before the pole shift, the Venus pole shift, had, in the days of Atlantis, when the Atlantic Ocean, the world, entire world ocean was the Atlantic Ocean, the ocean of the Atlanteans. Pacific Ocean was named by Magellan, when he went into the Pacific on his route around the world. That's when they named the Pacific Ocean. It wasn't until, what, the 1500s that the name Pacific Ocean came along. In the days of the Atlanteans, remember the North Pole, the ice cap at the North Pole wasn't there. That was a trade route. And South America, or and I'm sorry, the Antarctica was a coastline that they followed. That was a populated area. This is back before the pole shift. Okay, so at any rate, Columbus thought he was in India. But the point is that the intelligent people of, back as far as the Greeks, knew that the earth was round. They knew pretty much about how big it was. but nobody was able to sail out there. You didn't have the ships available, and even the ships that Columbus had were coastal sailing ships. The Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria were coastal sailing ships. And he took them across the ocean and made it. Only one of them made it all the way back to Portugal on the return trip, and a lot of the guys died on the way. But the belief amongst the people, the workers, the worker bees, the sailors with Columbus, was that the earth was flat, and they were going to hit a point where there were storms and dragons and fire and wind, and they were going to fall off the edge of the earth and just fall into nothingness. So when the storm hit, the famous storm that Columbus, no, we're going to continue going west, you know, in spite of the fact that they were separated and out in the, I can't even imagine being on this little coastal sailing ship in the middle of what are probably 50-foot waves, with the waves breaking over the ship and the sailors on there all knowing that they're about ready to die. And Columbus is like, no, we're going west, you know, ready, the whole ship's ready to kill Columbus and turn around. Good grief. Excuse me, but I just can't even imagine the situation there. But they made it to the new world and opened up, you know, what was eventually, it was going to happen anyway. It's just that Columbus was the first guy, and of course the Vikings made it over there. The Vikings had to be one rough crew of people, because the North Sea has got to be one of the worst, roughest, coldest, most unbelievably, horrifically harsh ocean, you know, passages in the world. And they did it just all the time with their longboats. But at any rate, the point is that man has this innate, insatiable interest in going out and looking up at the stars and wondering. And so the natural thing for man would be to go up and go into space and pursue his birthright to the stars. Well, what's stopping it? It's an outfit called NASA that, and I've told this story before too, when the Cindy McCullough space shuttle blew up, you know, teacher in space thing, every student in the country, and this was pre-planned. This was pre-planned, I guarantee you 100%. That the you know, you have the teacher in space program where every school recommended their science teacher to go into space, and they all competed, and then it was like a final filter down and filter down. They finally settled on this one woman teacher to go into space, and she's all dressed up. She's got her astronaut costume on and gets on the space shuttle, and the thing blows up. Every college student, every high school student, every school in the United States and probably in all of Europe was watching this. And what was the message that it sent to everybody? Hey, you can't go into space, it's dangerous. This is the modern version of the flat earth. The reason the Catholic Church taught the plebeians, the commoners, that the earth was flat was, and that there was an ocean out there with fire-breathing dragons and everything horrible, so that the young men who would be adventurous and want to go out and sail off into the distance, so that they wouldn't do it. They were mentally controlled, and that's what's going on today. Your spirit by education. Look at K-12. What do? You sit behind a desk. You sit behind a desk for you know what? You know what? 9 years, 10 years? And somebody is up in the front of the classroom, and you have to sit there and listen and then take exams, and they let you out the door for 15 minutes and come running back in, you have to sit some more. That's insanity. Kids got to be up moving around and playing and doing stuff. So what is that whole regiment of school doing for you? The No Child Left Behind program, whatever it is, it's regimenting kids and putting them in a box, and especially destroying their spirits, you know, so that they'll never pursue their interest. And this is coming out. I saw a thing with Jordan Peterson the other day, a video, And he was talking about how could schools get through, K-12, you come out of 12th grade, and they've never pursued finding what the kid's interest is. What's this kid interested in? What is he good at? What are his talents? How do you develop those talents in grade school? A kid comes out, and every kid learns the same thing from the same set of textbooks, and they call that diversity? No, it's the opposite of diversity. Everybody comes out the same with a rubber stamp on their soul, on their brain, and on their body. It's just insanity, absolute insanity. And so, anyway, it's to stamp out the spirit. And now you have Google having international consortium on schools where they want everybody to learn the same thing. Artificial intelligence teachers, they're replacing the teachers. So when a student asks a question, it goes into the AI bin and out comes the official answer. How convenient. How convenient. So at any rate, this is all to squelch, just like the flat earth, the church teaching the plebeians in the Middle Ages that the earth was flat and you can't go out there. They're doing the same thing, but relative to outer space. Even they're even trying to tell people that the earth is flat. What I keep I don't even want to go there. But you can measure the circumference of the world. It's very easy to do. And but the end result is that they're squelching the human spirit, basically. And so what is science doing? What is science doing? Well, the Big Bang, evolution, Carl Sagan with the Cosmos series drove this home that there's two levels of evolution. You have the Big Bang 13 billion years ago, which of course is just pure garbage. You have the Nobel Prizes being awarded for that in global climate change science, goofy science. But the Carl Sagan, two levels of evolution. One is the physical evolution of the universe, the Big Bang, 13 billion years ago by 4 billion years ago, or 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth is forming, and then all of a sudden you're driving up and down the road with your SUV. What could be wrong with that? Okay, so that's that part, but then the evolution of biological life just kind of springs out of that. They don't explain how that magically happens or how evolution, how you evolved from the monkey. They just say it. They just say it. And then they, I love it when they say there's a missing link. Oh, yeah? There's about 8,000 missing links. There's not one missing link. There's about 8,000 because the monkeys didn't just pop from monkey to man. There would have been thousands of transitions in there, and you'd be finding bones all over the place, but you don't. They're looking for one set of bones that's what, in between monkey and man? No, there would be thousands and thousands of them, and they'd be all over the place. But no, you don't find that. Man did not evolve from the monkey. Get used to it, But what do they do with little kids? The first day they walk into kindergarten, they show them this picture of man, little monkey running around with its claws on the ground, and the next stage they're a little more upright till finally man is walking completely upright. Visual, what would you call it, propaganda that man somehow evolved from this monkey, absurdities. And no, not a single shred of evidence at all. So, in the real story is that man goes back hundreds of thousands of years or more on this planet, and there's clear evidence of that. People are starting to realize that. And the if you're going to a university to get a degree, they're still teaching this this goofiness. If you get a PhD in geology or in anthropology or archaeology, yeah, they're still stressing this that man, I just heard Neil deGrasse Tyson the other day say that all men came from descendants from African black people. As an absurdity, an absurdity. because the white people are not the dominant genetic strain. If you mix black with white, you get black. The majority of the traits will be black. That's just the way it is. So how did man, white man, evolve from black people? Or vice versa. Either way, it doesn't work. These are two different, in I don't know, there's no really good word for this, two different divisions of human development. And I don't use the word like species is a terrible word, just overused, misused, etc. But the whole concept that man evolved out of Mesopotamia and somehow crossed the Bering Strait to populate the Western Hemisphere, by the time that supposedly happened, 12,000 years ago, there were fully developed civilizations in Peru, in Mexico, in Central America, fully developed, and the people that look very different than their Asian counterparts. So at any rate, but getting back to the issue of science and putting it into perspective, the most important part of understanding the human dilemma that we're having today is understanding the spirit. Okay, so where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? And by the way, sometimes I give grief to like some talking points relative to Elon Musk, but there's a person who's pursuing his interests, and what's the big difference between him and me? His money. He's got a lot of it. I don't have any. So I've never been a business person. He manages to pull off these business deals, and everything he touched turns to platinum. Anyway, but there's somebody who's carving the pathway to the stars for the human race. So I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about the reality of the financial institutions in the world today, and this includes the Chinese, includes the Russians to a degree, and of course the Western world, where the hub of, excuse me, where the hub of space activity is in the United States. So the United States spends more money on outer space than all the rest of the countries combined, just like as with military. And of course, then there's the space programs that you don't see, the secret ones. That are, for example, this was decades ago. I remember it was the same year as the Janet Jackson fiasco at the Super Bowl, whatever year that was. But the reason I know that because the front of the newspaper had that as the top headline. And on the back page of the same newspaper, like would be probably a New York newspaper or one of the major newspapers. On the back page was the budget, the national budget. And so you go through, and NASA had at the time a little bit less than $20 billion a year budget. I think about $17 billion per year was the national budget for NASA. And the Navy had a budget of $60 billion for aerospace procurement. In other words, what that would mean is that the Navy, this is the Navy now, not talking the Air Force or the other branches where there would be significant spending on outer space, had a good 3.5 times the national NASA budget for simply procurement of hardware. That didn't include the people and the staff and the facilities and everything else that would have had to go with that. And this is on the back page. So I'm sure 99.9% of the people never got off the front page with the Janet Jackson fiasco at the Super Bowl. And nobody really noticed, except I noticed that little fun fact about the funding of aerospace in the United States. So who knows what's really going on out there? I've been personally around in my wanderings through my career. I've been around military science, tier one science. I know it's there. I know where things go on and the type of things. If you're not aware, I've been in military meetings discussing things like electromagnetic propulsion systems, my work, plasma physics. I gave invited talks in Los Alamos National Laboratories. And so I've been around, I've been on the inside, even though I never worked for the government. So these things exist. But the garbage science they pawn off on you, the public, is NASA, the smoke screen of the space program. And the whole point, like I say, the whole point of that is just to keep you, the public, over here, paying the bill for NASA and thinking that's the top layer of space science when it is not at all. That's the facade. That's the smoke screen. That's the wizard behind the curtain, whatever you want to call it. So, but anyway, so where does this leave you or people like myself who's a scientist that wants to work? Okay, there's three things that you have to do. And this is also related to the craziness that's going on in the world right now. Number one is you have to have your feet firmly planted on planet Earth. You have to be able to take care of yourself and your family, if you have family, on a very basic level. That is, providing for yourself on a very basic level and understanding what it takes. Because, when you're living on a very basic level, like say the level of the 1800s or before the Industrial Revolution, before supermarkets, before transportation of goods over international boundaries, before lettuce came in from 3,000 miles away to be on the shelf the next day, whatever. You have to have your feet on the ground and be able to provide for yourself on that level. So that's basic number one. Okay, number two is to be able to live in the modern world. So to have checking accounts, bank accounts, doing business or working, whatever you do, and living a life that is in the what we call the real world. So yes, the real world. And then number three is there's going to be a certain number of people, and this is where young people come in, the people with energy and vision, and they want to do something. That's the kind of attitude that, say, kids grow up with. They want to be in a rock band, for example, or to be a surfer, something where you have freedom. You get out there on that wave and you're riding a wave and it's you and the wave, or you and the rock band, where you're being creative. You're just, you're letting it go. You're going off into directions that nobody has ever gone before. And but to go into outer space is something else because you're very limited. There's really not a lot of resources. It's not like you can go down to a place like the YMCA or the what other kids organizations are there? The place where you do rollerboarding, what do you call it? Skateboarding, that's built by the city, and you can go there and do your thing with rollerboards. Or skateboards, I'm sorry, rollerboards. So how do you get involved in space? And there's nothing there. There's nothing there. And I'm going to try and change that. I've been trying to change this. I have an education program that I've developed for K-12 students and their parents, because first of all, you have to educate the parents, because they were educated in a school system that was failed from the time they walked into school as kindergarten or even preschool, if they went to preschool. Probably a lot of parents today did. But there's no place for kids to go to get a taste of outer space. NASA used to have summer camps. I don't think they have them anymore. Maybe they do. But they're, it's like kind of like Disney World. It's like I say, it's cotton candy science. It's just a lot of fluff. It's to make you feel good, make the parents feel good, and make sure you keep sending those tax dollars. That's what that's for. But it's not about kids really understanding and learning how to go into space. Let's take something else. If you take a young kid and they're around horses, say on a ranch or something like that, they grow up around horses. Or if you take young kids and they live by the beach and they learn how to swim, it's very different than a kid that lives inland that never sees water, never sees a swimming pool, and has no idea how to swim or what's going on in the ocean. Kids that grow up with say their parents were surfers, and they're going to be surfers because they grew up with it. It's just like, oh, that's what you do. You go out on that board there and you get on a wave and you ride it. So kids, but relative to outer space, kids don't have anything to do. There's not a single thing in society, and that's on purpose. That's on purpose. That's to keep you from going into outer space. Do you think that's by accident? Do you think with all the money that's being spent on education that there shouldn't be a smidgen out there relative to outer space and kids' interest in going into outer space? I'm not talking about learning about how to use your backyard telescope. I'm talking about physically going into outer space because kids are not seeing their parents do it. Kids are not seeing the guy down the street do it. Kids are not seeing anybody at their school do it or at their university or their college. Nobody, it's not something that's done. Yet it's the core thing that is in your spirit, the birthright to the stars. Just absolutely incredible. That's one of the most fundamental things, most fundamental basic aspects of your existence. There's not a shred of movement in that direction. So at any rate, one thing that I'm taking a severe interest in is trying to encourage young people to look into science. And I'm not talking about, like I say, the cotton candy science that comes from NASA or from the school system or from textbooks. I'm talking about real science, not the garbage science, the tier two science that is passed off on the public. So that's the first thing that kids have to understand when they realize that all of the different aspects of what's going on in outer space, including the natural disasters that have limited severely the human race development over the last, say, 10,000 years. We know that there were major developments. The Noah's flood was a comet event. We know that the Moses event was a comet event. The Moses event was when the large comet Venus came by Earth and did a severe amount of damage. The Mayans talk about it. The Noah's flood was where Earth passed through a comet tail for a period of about 40 days and 40 nights. That's the reckoning we get from the Old Testament. And there was severe flooding, the ocean's level rose, and the vast majority of people on planet Earth died. It was not a pretty sight. And so the descendants that come down from, in fact, that's what the Old Testament is. It's a lineage of the happenings, the people who developed after these events, all the way down to where Christ was born. Christ was the house of David, the Hebrews, and descendants from Abraham. And by the way, here's some interesting things, and I've been looking into this recently. There are letters that were written by the Roman leaders at the time of Christ's crucifixion. And they had encounters with Christ before the crucifixion. He had blonde hair. He was they called it golden hair. That's how blonde hair he was. He was a Caucasian, blue eyes, and a magnetic personality, from what they were saying, just completely magnetized the people who came up with him and the people to be in the same room But anyway, Pontius Pilate had run into him a couple times previously and actually had some conversations directly with him. This is before the night of the, being turned in and the crowds, crucify him, crucify him. But anyway, it's very interesting to see that these pieces of history are laid out. But the Hebrews, the people that came out of Egypt with Moses, were Israelites. They were not Jews, they were Israelites, they were Hebrews, descendants of Abraham. And they eventually populated up to the Caucasian Mountains, the Caucasus, the Caucasus Mountains in Western Russia, into Northern Europe, into Scandinavia, and eventually into Ireland. So, but the point is that the human race has been highly developed a number of times previously, and to the point where they were spacefaring. So, the point we're at now is the people who that control the world, basically the bankers, don't want you to know this type of information. It's being held back in the, like I say, what's being taught in the schools. Sit a kid at a desk for K-12 till he can't think for himself, taught a bunch of complete garbage, has no ability to reason, and then make him into some kind of a worker bee that is trained to obey rules and maybe go into the military, be on the front line or whatever, vote in the popular election or whatever. It's all completely controlled. And so it's for parents and young people to break out of this mold. And literally, it is the Matrix. It is literally the Matrix. I just want to let you know something, that my webpage has been updated greatly. Pretty much all of the radio shows going back to about 2006 are there. There's a few missing previous to that. Those will be updated very soon. But then also, I'm putting together a brand new package of my information, what you might call products, my books, CDs, DVDs, the education package, and there's some new items that are going to be packaged, and that I'm going to be turning my work towards educating young people, finishing about six books that I have yet to come out this year, and doing a lot of let's just say contacting the public to start living the life that they should be living. So, and this show is just kind of like a primer to what's going on, getting people mentally prepared for what they really should be doing with their lives. So I'm out of time. We'll talk to you next week. Remember to visit the webpage jmccsci.com and jmccwaterfilters.com. And this is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.